committee to order for Monday, March 4th. We have a member on his way down, so we should have a quorum, but we'd like to get started because we do have a pretty long list of bills. The first on our list today is Senate File 658. Senator Dietzick, welcome to the committee. And I will just announce right now that quorum is present for the record. Senator Dietzick, to your bill.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. With me today to discuss Senate File 658 is the Department of Labor and Industry Assistant Commissioner Jessica Luman. Senate File 658 details with the misrepresentation of the employment relationship. Currently, the Department of Labor and Industry has the authority to issue compliance orders to construction companies when they misclassify a worker. This bill gives them authority to address other industries. According to a 2007 legislative audit report, misclassification occurs in the healthcare, retail, and manufacturing fields. This report estimated that 14% of Minnesota employers misclassify at least one worker as an independent contractor. I believe most of those employers are making honest mistakes, but unfortunately, some deliberately classify people as independent contractors. The legislative report stated that misclassification is a problem in Minnesota because it can negatively affect the thousands of employees who are misclassified, the large majority of employers who appropriately classify workers, and state tax revenues. This bill levels the playing field. I will now ask Ms. Luman to go over specific details of the bill.
Ms. Luman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. As the senator has so clearly put, this law really refers, it puts into 177.27, which is the Department of Labor and Industry Commissioner's duties and authorities. It puts the ability to address the misrepresentation of the employment relationship that's found in currently in law in 181.722. What that law says is that no employer shall misrepresent the nature of its employment relationship with its employees to any federal, state, or local government unit, to other employers, or to its employees. And an employer misrepresents the nature of its employment relationship with its employees if it makes any statement regarding the nature of the relationship that the employer knows or has reason to know is untrue, and if it fails to report individuals as employees when legally required to do so. Again, this is already in Minnesota law. The trick is that currently it's unlawful to misclassify any workers, but workers don't have any ability to have that law enforced on their behalf. That law, 181.722, does provide for a private right of action for construction workers, but not for workers outside of the construction industry. The Department of Labor and Industry is requesting the authority to put in our powers and duties of the commissioner the ability to enforce this misrepresentation of the employment relationship law. The proposal continues our work in the addressing the misclassification of workers as independent contractors. As the senator stated, this started in 2007 with a legislative auditor's report that specifically referenced this 181.722 law, stating that it would be helpful, a recommendation, that we actually allow for enforcement of this provision. We also have a memorandum of understanding with the U.S. Department of Labor related to the misclassification of workers in and out of the construction industry. And as you all know, this is an issue that is being dealt with all over the country, and that there are no silver bullets to this issue. It's just a matter of making sure that we put people on notice that it's important that you classify workers as either employees or independent contractors based on the work that they're actually performing and the actual business relationship between those two entities. Under this provision, we will have the Department of Labor and Industry will have the ability to issue a notice, which we currently can't do, that says that you are misrepresenting the employment relationship with these workers. And the good part about that is at the Department of Labor and Industry, we're really all about compliance, outreach, education, and compliance. And this gives us an opportunity to do that kind of outreach and compliance in a way we've never have before. And then in the event, because we know this is going to come up, in the event that there is willful and repeated violations of the misrepresentation along with the recommendations of the legislative auditors, there would be the ability to issue a penalty for willful and repeated violations of this provision of up to $1,000 per violation.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Any questions?
Senator Dietzick, thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Any questions from the committee members? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, if there is an improper classification, wouldn't a lot of that be corrected through the Department of Revenue or the IRS? Because then obviously there are different tax withholding laws and that type of thing that need to be put into place on the part of the employers. So wouldn't some of that actually get enforced through that level?
Assistant Commissioner?
Chairman Sparks, Senator Weber, yes, that's true. And one of the things that we're really trying to do in the administration is labor and industry as wage and hour and as workers' compensation, the Department of Employment and Economic Development as the Unemployment Insurance Division, and revenue are all really trying to work together more, which was another recommendation from the legislative auditor, work together more on resolving these issues. This is just one additional tool.
Senator Weber, did that answer your question? Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Luman, is the reason why you can issue this penalty up to $1,000 is because that chapter of law gives that authority with that dollar amount as the cap?
Ms. Luman.
Because I asked the question because I don't see anything in the bill that pertains to that.
Ms. Luman?
Chairman Sparks, Senator Bonner. That's true. Under the powers and duties for failure, willful and repeated is in a different provision of the 177.27, and it is up to a $1,000 penalty.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Would anyone else like to testify in Senate File 658? Seeing none, I would look for a motion, members. Senator Schmidt moves that Senate File 658 be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Dietzer.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is Senate File 613, Senator Scalzi. PFA provision modifications. Senator Scalzi, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. This bill, Senate File 613, is one for the Public Facilities Authority, otherwise known as the PFA, who's the multi-agency financing authority that helps finance infrastructure programs for mainly smaller communities that don't have resources to replace failing stormwater and wastewater systems. This legislation would expand the ability of the maximum load grant program. It also changes some technical assistance grants for the small community wastewater treatment program. And also there are some changes within the wastewater infrastructure funding program, otherwise known as WIF, W-I-F. So here today is Jeff Freeman, the executive director of the PFA, to explain the bill.
Executive Director, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. In your packets, you should have a handout that summarizes the bill with our little PFA valve logo at the top. As Senator Scalzi said, what we're doing here with is primarily this bill focuses on the programs that the PFA administers that are funded from Clean Water Legacy Funds. Essentially, these programs provide additional assistance to cities when they are required through their permit to provide an additional level of treatment over and above what they would otherwise have to do to address a specific water quality goal. And that's done right now through two different programs. The first two that are on the handout, the TMDL grant program focuses on when a total maximum daily load study is done. There's kind of a lengthy process for the study being done, an implementation plan prepared, approval by EPA. And then once all that happens, a city can access these grant funds, 50% up to $3 million. There's also a process or a separate, right now a totally separate program for phosphorus when a city is required through its permit to do phosphorus reduction below levels that they would otherwise have to do. That's a separate program. So one of the big things we want to do, the two separate programs there, there's actually a lot of overlap, and it's confusing for cities administratively difficult to have two separate programs. We want to bring those two together and just merge them into one program. And then also to expand the eligibility slightly to allow any time a city is required by its permit to provide this additional level of treatment, these grant funds would be available. At the bottom of the, and that's sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill. Sections 4, 5, and 6 of the bill focus on the small community program. This is the program that addresses very small, unsewered communities, generally 20 to 30 households or smaller. There's a technical assistance grant component of that program. There's also construction financing. These are really challenging situations in many cases, and we'd like to raise slightly the cap on the technical assistance grants from $40,000 to $60,000. We'd like to raise the cap on the construction funds to $2 million, and we'd like to change the grant component of the construction funding to match the affordability criteria in our current wastewater infrastructure funding program, the WIF program that works for a little bit larger communities. We kind of want to use those same criteria for this program so the grants are kind of a level playing field regardless of the program. Finally, Section 7 of the bill addresses a situation with the WIF program for cities that got assistance during the time frame from 2005 to 2010. Prior to that, the WIF program provided assistance in the form of a grant for communities that meet affordability criteria. These are sort of the financial hardship communities that have to do a wastewater project. The WIF program provides supplemental assistance to help them do that project. In 2005, the program was changed to be a deferred loan program instead of grants, to try to match our funding better with USDA Rural Development, which is one of our major partners for many of these communities. That changed back in 2011 back to a grant program again, because we were able to make some other modifications to our regular loan program. Bottom line is, these communities, we made 16 deferred loans in that time frame of 2005 to 2010. Everybody before them got a grant, and everybody after is now getting grants under an affordability criteria. We would like to use that current affordability criteria, apply it back to these communities that got the deferred loans, and to the extent they would trigger a grant, instead convert that existing loan to a grant. So there's no outlay of money with these. These are projects that have already been funded and built. It would just forgive or relieve some of the debt payments that these cities would otherwise have to repay. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about any section of the bill.
Thank you. pardon me. And I think Council said there's a couple repealers in the bill as well. If you want to address that, maybe Mr. Knopf or Executive Director.
Mr. Chair, yes, there is a repealer that would take away the current phosphorus reduction grant program because, as I said, we're merging that in with the TMDL grant program, actually. And then there's some instructions, I think some revisor instructions, to change the name to Point Source Implementation Grants, which doesn't have a catchy acronym, but I think would make it kind of simpler for everybody to understand.
And I believe Council said there might be one more.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, if you look on page or on line 5.4, you'll see also 446A.051 subdivision 2. And that is a grant limitation that says that under the current three programs, the community small grant program, the phosphorus, or the TMDL grant program, they can't exceed the amount that they could receive under the WIF program. So that's also being eliminated here, so that limitation on those grants will be removed.
Yes, Mr. Chair, actually that language was originally put in because originally the phosphorus reduction program was a 75% grant. The TMDL grants were 50%, and there were questions about, well, if somebody would get both, how does this all fit together? And that's what that language addressed. But if we sort of merge it into one program, we take away that confusion, and there's not the need then for that language.
Mr. Freeman, under the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program, is the goal here to change and raise those caps just to allow you guys to get more of those projects underway and allow you the freedom to kind of do that? Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, exactly, Mr. Chair. These are really tough situations to find sort of. They're such small communities, but they have, in most cases, straight pipe raw sewage discharges. So it's a high priority from both an environmental and public health problem situation. But they need a little more money on the front end, the technical assistance grant, to really figure out what they can do that's also affordable. And then on the construction side, the current structure of $500,000 cap for 3 years doesn't work very well, and the $2 million will really fit better for the type of projects that we're seeing.
Thank you, and obviously we're dealing with the policy issues, but can you tell us kind of overall, I know that you'll have to go to Senator Tomasoni's committee to get your funding, but are we starting to make some good headway in many of these projects? I mean, I know it's very important for us statewide as we try to clean these systems up, and I know there's quite a lengthy list, but I think that you know, obviously how much money he's going to put towards that will have an effect, but are we starting to move in the right direction?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes, members, yes, we are. In fact, the overall priority list, all of these programs follow the same priority list. It's set by the Pollution Control Agency based on their criteria of environmental and public health factors. That list has projects, not all of them are ready to go, generally a five-year list of projects that are in various stages and working through the engineering process. That list used to be, not too many years ago, was in excess of $2 billion. I think we got up as high as $2.2 billion. Right now, that current list is about $1.4 billion. So we've funded a lot of projects in the past few years, addressed a lot of those needs. There's still, of course, a significant amount of projects each year. We've got about $200 million of requests every year. Our loan program finances the bulk of those. But these grant programs are very important as to help the projects be more affordable, but also as an incentive for these cities that need to make these additional treatment requirements in order to address particular water quality goals. These grants allow those cities to take on that additional treatment and advance those projects more quickly than they would otherwise be able to do.
Great, thank you. Are there further questions? Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 613? If not, Senator Eakin, would you want to move the bill?
Sure.
Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 613 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Energy. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Scholes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next up, we have Senate File 640, Senator Hoffman, Trade Policy Advisory Group. So, come up to the table, and whenever you're ready, welcome to the committee, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to get in front of you to talk about Senate File 640. Prior to it being read, Mr. Chair, I do have, there's an Amendment A1, which is an author's amendment to with an insert of some new language. Indulge the committee.
And I'm told, we'll do this. It was just a miscounting of a number, so pretty minor. But I think if members are okay with that, we would. Would someone like to?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the. Is it the A1? It's cut off.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Yep. The A1 author's amendment. Senator Nelson moves the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Nelson. There's also one other clarification that if the chair would like, there is one of the farmer groups was left out of the language, and we'd like to eventually see both the Farmers Bureau and the Farmers Union be admitted as that advisory group as well. That's something we can work on either as a oral amendment here, Mr. Chair, or something we can do later on.
Do it now, or then I'm talking about it. Can you kind of look at it?
Is that all right?
Senator Hoffman, let's work with Council. Maybe Mr. Fuller's got a suggestion if this is what you're looking to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't mean to name names, but just I mean two farmer organizations. So,
Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chair, members, would it be on line 11 and change to two and representative, two representative organizations representing family farmers? Or page 1, line 13, I'm sorry.
Good. We're good.
Or should we do the same thing? Representative.
That works.
Is it working well?
Yeah, let's work on it.
Senator Hoffman, why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about the bill? We'll give council a chance to review that, and then we'll come back to that, if that's okay with you. So
thank you, Mr. Okay. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 640 is a trade policy advisory group, and that creates a permanent trade policy advisory group. The group is composed of 12 members, actually 13, including 7 appointed by the governor, the commissioner of employment and economic development, and then 4 legislators. And the commissioner must provide administrative assistance to the group, Mr. Chair and members. And let me just let you know that public members of the group serve without compensation or expense reimbursement. Mm-hmm. So we're getting a win-win, and it's not coming out anybody's pockets. The principal charge of the group is to advise the governor and us, our body, concerning the government procurement agreements, the United States trade agreements. Just an FYI, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the advisory group is similar to the trade policy advisory group by laws in 2008, which Chapter 300, Section 4, but that group, Mr. Chair, sunsetted June 30th of 2012. So this is really reinvoking that group and moving it forward. And why it's important is because creating jobs in Minnesota for Minnesotans is important, and being at the table when we're talking about trade policy is important. And Mr. Chair, as you know, Minnesota currently runs about a $12 billion trade deficit, and this gets folks back at the table, making sure that we're equalizing that playing field and moving forward to create good, sustainable jobs right here in Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have Josh Wise, who's the director of the Minnesota Fair Trade Coalition. We're going to hear from him, as well as Richard Ryan, who's the assistant directing business representative organizer for District Lodge 77 of our international machinists. So, Mr. Chair.
Wonderful. Thank you. Which one of you gentlemen would like to go first? Please just say your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Josh Wise. I direct the Minnesota Fair Trade Coalition. I'll let Rick do most of the talking, but as Senator Hoffman said, this is re-establishing a group that already existed. We're hoping that in the current the way it's set up in this bill, it will be more effective than it was in previous years. It's now comprised primarily of citizens who have a vested stake in seeing trade policy that works for all Minnesotans. So we think this is a much more effective way to do a comprehensive analysis of how trade is affecting Minnesota. So I'll turn it over to Rick.
Mr. Ryan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Sparks and members. My name is Richard Ryan. I am the Assistant Directing Business Representative for District Lodge 77 of the Machinist Union. I'm also Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota State Council of Machinists. The IM represents more than 12,000 active and retired members in manufacturing, paper and pulp, transportation, and various service sectors in Minnesota, and more than 700,000 in the U.S. and Canada. In the past decade or so, our members in the manufacturing sector have been under severe economic pressure, we feel due in large part to ill-conceived trade agreements that have created downward pressure on wages, environmental standards, labor rights, and human rights. These agreements have caused untold harm to the middle class in our country and in Minnesota. As an example, a report from the Economic Policy Institute dated August 23, 2012, stated that since China joined the WTO in 2001, in the following 10 years, more than 2.1 million manufacturing jobs were lost in the U.S., including 72,300 jobs in Minnesota to trade with China. That equaled 2.66% of total state employment during that time, which is the fifth highest loss in the country. In addition, the first congressional district was the 20th highest district for loss of jobs due to trade with China in the country. So it's been a real, it's real people losing real jobs that are family supporting jobs, the kind of jobs we want in Minnesota, the kind of jobs that we all say that we want or want to grow. So clearly, trade agreements can have a great effect on those kind of good-paying, family-supporting jobs that everybody says they want to have. I was appointed to be one of the labor representatives to the prior Trade Policy Advisory Group, and I participated in its meetings and deliberations. And while formatting trade policy is a federal issue, we feel, along with the Fair Trade Coalition, that states can and should have a role in how these agreements are implemented within our borders, and how we the proposed Trade Policy Advisory Group is a way for the administration and the legislature to gain insight and practical knowledge from Minnesotans directly impacted by these policies, and to propose ways to help mitigate the negative impact on trade policy of trade policy on Minnesota families. So thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Any questions for the Senator Deems?
Mr. Chair and Senator Huffman, could you tell me the appointees will be on this board? Is that similar to what the committee was that was set up in 2008?
Yes. Senator Huffman, you want to try that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deems, the answer is yes. Thank similar.
Senator Eakin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, I was wondering how often they're going to be expected to meet. It sounds like it's kind of at the determination of the board itself or the chair. Okay. I guess, you know, how often the current board has been meeting.
Last time we had, I think, two or three meetings. The administration at that time and the deed commissioner was not real excited about the policy advisory group during the Plenty administration. We did prepare a report to the legislature, which was submitted. So it was a compromise report, as you can imagine. We had Bill Blazer was on the panel from the chamber and other people from the business side and people from the labor side. So.
And Senator
Mr. Wise.
Senator, no, Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, one thing that's different about this time around is that we're requiring the advisory group to issue a report no less than once a year. So it will be actually written into law that it's required to produce something every year.
Senator Eakin.
And Mr. Chair, and I was just a comment, I guess. I understand, you know, your desire not to have the compensation and reimbursement so that it doesn't incur a greater cost. But I do have one concern about some of the greater Minnesota members of the board that may have to travel a great distance, and if there are meetings that go all day or something, that they may have to find accommodations, that maybe there be some consideration given to that so that there wouldn't be a greater cost incurred by the rural or greater Minnesota people serving on this board.
Put some money on the table.
Senator Hoffman, no, good point.
Senator Eakin, thank you. Is that a motion? I like that idea, actually. You know, we believe that this is such an important piece to Minnesota job creation and Minnesota jobs and leveling the playing field. Matter of fact, several other states have done the same similar advisory group, trade advisory group, and one success story is the country. There you go. This is a long day. State of Maine. State of Maine put a similar crafting the state's response to trade agreements, and they were solely responsible for helping retain an industry. New Balance tennis shoes are the last remaining tennis shoe company where the shoes are actually built right here in the United States and built in Maine. That trade advisory group really helped keep that as part of their infrastructure in the state. So that's an important piece of this, and we firmly believe that. That's why these folks have decided to do it without pay. But you know, if the good senator would like to put it on the table, I'd be more than happy to accept that as a friendly agreement.
Sure, Senator.
Kidding.
Hoffman. And just to Senator Dame's question, too, I do believe that there is a minor change in that. I think in the past, the commissioner of the Department of Ag and the commissioner of the Department of Administration was a part of the organization. Mr. Wise?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it is a bit different in that the appointees are representative of community organizations, and they'll be seeking advice and input from the commissioners. This was we did it this way as opposed to the way it was done last time, because we felt that the community had such a strong investment that they should be the ones who are the drivers of making sure that this happens and making the recommendations to the state.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dames and Senator Bonham. Senator Dames.
I do have a concern about that. You know, I think if you take a look at the percent of our exports, it certainly ag is going to be that highest percent. And I'm not so sure we ought to be taking the Department of Ag off of this board. I think that they could have some good representation on the board. And certainly I think that they are grounded as what's going on. And I think with as high a percent as our ag products are in the export market, I would really like to see those folks back on there.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Senator Dames, I don't have the old, I wasn't here last year, but was the Department of Ag part of the core group, or were they like an ex officio on that? Because, you know, there might be some discussion there, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I think council can help us out. Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, it was the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development, the Commissioner of Agriculture, the Commissioner of Administration, and the Attorney General were the officials named.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I guess we're never there.
Okay, that's fine.
Senator, you want to stay on this, Senator Dames?
Well, I really think that would you folks entertain an amendment to certainly put back the Commissioner of Agriculture and the Commissioner of Economic Development back on. Economic Development's on.
Yeah.
Would you agree to an amendment to put the Commissioner of Agriculture back on?
Senator Hoffman? Or would someone from the department like to?
We'd like to have.
No?
You know, yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
It's worthy of discussion. I think the last time it was there was not too much representation at those meetings from the commissioners themselves, but in an ex officio, it would make sense to me in an ex officio part, because you know, they're advising their expertise into the group on what, you know, expectations are. Because let's be clear, Senator Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, that this is an advisory group to advise and assist the governor and the legislature, and so there is no governance capacity in this. And I think, as for advisory groups, it would make sense for those in the higher level to be ex officio as opposed to being actual members. And that's just a thought to throw back at you. So,
well, Mr. Sir, Chair, Dames, my response to that would be, it's strictly an advisory group, so therefore I don't know that it makes a lot of difference if they're ex officio or not. I don't know that that's really the issue if they're ex officio. I guess I don't know why would we want to do that if we're going to ask them for advice, and this is an advisory group. I think they ought to come to the table and have a stake at the table. Clearly, as a minority lead in agriculture, I think we have to make sure that we have some representation from the ag communities, and we have some in here, but I don't really appreciate the fact that we've taken out the Department of Ag, and I would like to see them in, and I'm asking, would you entertain a friendly amendment to do that, or would you not?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, absolutely. You know, egg still is 23, 24, 25% of our product here in the state of Minnesota, and I accept that as a friendly amendment to be added.
Okay.
And I would so move that amendment.
Right. Let's see if Mr. Fuller can get that so everyone's clear what we're going to do here. Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames moves that on page 1, after line 17, add a clause 7, the Commissioner of Agriculture, or designee, semicolon, and then renumber the remaining clauses 8 to be 8 and 9. And then there's a number up there on line 10 that says it's actually 12 by amendment, so that would go to 13.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Two ag groups.
I know. Yeah, they've been coming. Next. Okay. Are members clear of the Senator Dames' oral amendment to add the Commissioner of Ag and then basically do some renumbering of the advisor group? Any further discussion? All those in favor of the Senator Dames' oral amendment, please or say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The amendment is adopted. Thank you very much. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Hoffman, for bringing this forward. I concur with the comments made by Senator Eakin with regard to the expenses related to lodging. It seems to me, particularly because you identify two family farmers and depending on the distance they have to travel. So I'm wondering if Senator Hoffman, a compromise might be on line number 2.12 after the word expenses. If you added, with the exception of reimbursement for expenses related to lodging, and perhaps council might have a better way to say it, but I was just trying to make sure that should those members have to stay overnight, that they would have their expenses covered. I can't imagine it's going to be a very big fiscal note.
Senator Eakin, let's keep on this. That's fine. Do you have a comment on this?
Yeah, I was just going to, and thank you for that amendment. I was wondering if we could do that here, since we're supposed to be dealing with policy, or if it had to be done in a different committee. But I guess my suggestion might be just to remove or payment of expenses, if that would accomplish the same goal, because. Payment of expenses isn't compensation, so that would still leave it open at least to payment.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, I consider that too, but traditionally, if we don't have payment of expenses spelled out, then everybody's allowed to have the per diem rate, I believe, of $55 per day or something. So it seemed as though there was an intent of the author not to incur that expense, and so therefore by just singling this out I thought it might narrow it. And with regard to the fiscal note, you know, whether or not we put this on it here or not, it still obviously would have to go to the finance side.
That's true.
Mr. Chair, were
Senator
you
Bonoff.
What was your intention about where this bill would go?
Right now, it was scheduled to go to state and local. I suppose if we had this, it would have another stop in finance. Senator Eakin or Senator Hoffman thought. Senator Eakin.
And Mr. Chair, and I see the intent, Senator Bonoff, and I understand as far as the per diem is concerned. So I would probably add to it, in addition to lodging, probably travel as well, the mileage that's involved as well. But that would be the only other suggestion I would have.
Senator Bonner, further comments?
Mr. Chair, Senator Eakin, that would be fine with me, but I guess I'm looking for some direction from Senator Hoffman, because then now this bill has a fiscal note, and so it has a different path, and so just wonder.
Right. Senator Hoffman, we certainly want to hear from you.
Mr. Chair, Senators Eakin and Bonoff, I greatly appreciate the additional per diems or the conversation of lodging. Our hope and intent was to get this moved on to state and local government, because we're pending some short timelines here. And if we go to finance, does that stack this up? So this is really important for the creation of jobs, and the people that want to see this move are really driven to really have the conversation started, and I happen to agree with them. So in my haste to get that moving and get it moved on, that's why the agreement was that at no payment. So if this goes, it would go to Senator Tomasoni's then committee. Is that correct, Mr. Chair? Would that stack us up?
Well, Senator Hoffman, obviously that would be a budget committee, so they'd have an extra week. It'd probably go to finance, Senator Cohen's committee. Senator Saxog, I'm being told, has state and local government budget division. Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this group in its 4 years did not have any payment to them, and they're willing to do it again.
Yeah,
so in the interest of time and the importance of this, I would just as soon see this move on as its regular entity was, and thank you for the friendly amendment, but I would like to see this pass out and refer to state and local government.
Senator Bono.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw the amendment.
Okay. We're trying to help you get some money here,
I love
Senator
you guys.
Hoffman.
This is, I know, thank you.
But anyway, I think it was a good discussion.
It was great.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Or do we want to go back and try to fix the two members from the farmers organization? Is that something we could address now? Mm-hmm. Senate Council. Senator Fuller, there you go. Mr. Fuller, yeah.
On line 10, we changed now 13 to 14, Mr. Chair. And then on line 13, we would delete of after representative. And so it would read a representative from each of two separate organizations. So we'd add, delete of, and add from each of two separate organizations representing family farmers.
Senator Hoffman, does that sound amenable to you?
Mr. Chair, that is more than meaningful. We appreciate the fact that we're adding two family organizations, family members. That's
okay.
Good. Farmers.
Members.
Oops. Mr. Chair, just
Senator
for clarity,
Dames.
Senator Hoffman, just for clarity, that would include organizations such as, you mentioned, Farm Bureau Farmers Union. Would it also extend to Soybean Growers Association, to the corn producers, to those folks also? I'm assuming that's the broad scope it would include. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, those are the two at the top of my head that just came to mind when we were having this first discussion. But, you know, absolutely, if there's a soybean representation that wants to be part of this, go through the process of vetting through, you know, getting on commissions, and I think it's good. This is a win-win.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Senator Hoffman, excuse me. I just wanted to make sure that the commodity groups would have that input, so thank you.
Sure. Members clear on that oral amendment? Senator Coonan, would you be willing to move that?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I like the idea. So
okay.
I'll make that motion.
All right. Okay, then, members. Senator Coonan moves the oral amendment. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The oral amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, members
Senator
of the committee,
Hoffman.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Oh, wait. Senator Hoffman, we still got to move the whole bill.
Oh.
I'm so, Mr. Chair, I'm so excited to get out in that snow, man.
All right. Is there any further discussion on Senate File 640? Senator Nelson, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, I'd like to move Senate File 640. 640.
As amended, be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Senator Tomasoni, Senate File 644. Senator Tomasoni, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to be back. Mr. Chairman and committee members, Senate File 644 makes changes to existing state programs for employment support services for persons with mental illnesses. And people with mental illness have a high unemployment rate among all disability groups. And this is due to many factors, including stigma and discrimination, but it's also due to the fact that we have few programs developed to meet their needs. There is one program in Minnesota that is specifically tailored to meet the needs of people living with serious mental illness, and it's called the Extended Employment Program for People with Serious Mental Illness, and the acronym is EESMI. It has been typically funded at $1,555,000 per year. In the past couple of years, DEET has used the EESMI funds to support an evidence-based model of supported employment for people with a mental illness called Individual Placement and Support, or IPS. Minnesota currently funds six supported employment programs which use the IPS model through the Extended Employment Program for people with serious mental illness. Unfortunately, these providers cannot serve even a fraction of Minnesotans who would benefit. This bill updates the language regarding employment for people with a serious mental illness to reflect the components of IPS and increases the funding in order to start an additional eight projects serving over 250 people per year. The cost benefit of the IPS program is that people experience decreased use of hospitalization, crisis services, and day programs. They also have greater probability of working competitively and to become taxpayers. And so, Chairman, I would like to turn this over to my witnesses so they can give you a little bit better feel for why the bill is needed and what it will accomplish.
Great. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and I do have a handout as well. My name is Sue Abderholden, and I'm Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And we're very grateful for the time you're providing today to learn more about IPS, a type of supported employment program for people living with a serious mental illness. This committee and the legislature funds many different employment programs, and we wanted to make sure that you know about IPS and its effectiveness. When we talk about recovery in the mental health field, we pretty much mean someone has a home, a job, and a date on a Saturday night. But today I'd like to focus on the job part. Having a job provides structure, a reason to get up in the morning, and interactions with others, all important things when you live with a serious mental illness. But sadly, we have not done well in this area. Only 1 in 10 people with a mental illness are currently employed, and their unemployment rate is 3 to 5 times higher than for those without a mental illness. You cannot sit home in your apartment drinking coffee and especially watching daytime TV and expect to get better. We can and must do more. The IPS model has the potential for turning this around. We're very excited about it because it's effective, and there's national data along with state data that shows that it actually helps people with a mental illness obtain and retain employment. There are 8 components. 0 exclusion, which means if somebody wants to work, they get to work. They're eligible. Competitive employment is the goal, so people aren't working at, you know, below minimum wage. Rapid job search. This is really important. As soon as someone says they want to work, we go to work getting them a job. We don't say, well, you need to be symptom-free, you need to do this and that. It's just right away. It's time unlimited support. You can go back if the person needs it. I think you'll know that mental illness is cyclical in its nature, so you can't just place someone and then forget about them. They may need help later on, and this model allows them to come back. It's integrated with treatment, so you actually have the mental health providers working with the employment specialists. If you think about it, maybe someone is on medications that makes it difficult to get up in the morning, and yet there's a job ready for them, and so you can work with the medications and the timing so they can get up in the morning and go to that job. There's also benefits counseling. People need to know how it may impact their insurance in particular, so making sure that they will still keep their health insurance. Systematic job development, so the provider actually works to create jobs in the community and work with different employers and make sure they're, you know, educated about mental illness. And then attention to client preferences. We all, you know, like certain things more than other things, and so really working with the individual so that you find a job that they really want to do. People who are competitively employed through supportive employment programs have higher incomes, improved self-esteem, and improved quality of life, and are far less likely to need mental health services such as hospitalization, crisis services, and day programming. It's important to remember that serious mental illnesses is a leading contributor to the global burden of disease, and it's the fastest growing group under Social Security disability programs. Once someone is on a Social Security program, less than 1% per year move off and return to work. If we help people with mental illness gain employment, especially young adults experiencing their first psychotic episode, we can help them not become disabled by their mental illness. The annual cost nationwide for this model is $5,500 per client. If you prevent just 3 days of hospitalization, you will have paid for that. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for this opportunity to testify, and I hope you'll be able to support this bill.
Thank you, Mrs. Abderhold. Are there any questions for her? If not, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Grace Tangyard Schmidt. I am with Guild Incorporated, which is a private, not-for-profit community mental health and rehabilitation provider in the metropolitan area here. We provide an array of recovery-focused community treatment and rehabilitation services for adults who have schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and other serious mental illnesses. These illnesses, as you likely know, can affect most every aspect of an individual's life, often over a long time for many years. We then need to be able to help people in each of those life areas to be the most effective. Thus, we provide employment services to help people find, get, and keep jobs that are integrated with our outpatient mental health services. This means the employment specialist is an active member of the clinical mental health treatment team. Information is shared. There's one case record and one plan. Everybody's on the same page and supports employment. This integration of employment with mental health treatment is one feature of the individual placement and support employment model, which Sue was just talking about. I'll also briefly highlight three additional features. First, job finding is individualized. It's based on the preferences and strengths of the individual as well as that person's work experience and education. It may be part-time or full-time. Again, as is true for all of us, a good fit with our work helps us want to keep our job and have success and satisfaction. Second, as Sue said, competitive employment is the goal, which means individuals work in jobs that pay at least minimum wage and are open to anyone in the labor market, not just people with disabilities. And finally, the individual placement and support model includes follow-along support. Supports are proactive, meaning focuses on helping people manage their illness and stay as healthy as possible. And supports are ongoing for as long as the person needs them, not limited to 60 or 90 days. Individuals can also get help in changing jobs as they gain experience. I think of the follow-along support as a form of employee assistance. Serious mental illnesses are chronic health conditions, and as with other chronic conditions, symptoms do flare up from time to time. And easy access to assistance to manage a change in one's health condition can prevent job loss, which benefits the individual, the employer, and obviously our economy. The individual placement and support model is effective in helping those living with serious mental illnesses become part of the competitive labor market. And you'll have a chance to hear from Jamie Keelan next, who can describe how it works for him. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt. Keelan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Keelan, and I have a mental illness. I work at Mississippi Market, a local foods co-op in St. Paul. I've worked there since the spring of 1999, starting as a grocery stocker and now as a fruit bagger. The employment services team at Guild Incorporated helped me to prepare for interviews and coach me on how to present myself. Today, Esther with Guild helps me identify ways to improve my work. She also guides me on how to handle changes in my role and even speaks to my employer when I need help adjusting to change. Guild helps me to be more self-reliant. They've taught me how to balance my checkbook, manage my medications, explore my interests, and get through challenges at work. This is a perfect job for me. It combines two of my favorite things, healthy products and serving people. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing your story, Mr. Keelan.
Thank you.
Any questions for the witnesses or for Senator Thomas Lane? Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, looking at this, and certainly it's a very worthwhile goal, and you know, I certainly have no issues with that. The one thing that concerns me is when I read the subdivision one, it said county boards must provide. And what I want to have a little better understanding exactly of what that means, because I think over the course of years, states have piled on a lot of different costs, mandates to county government in this area, and I'd like to understand a little bit what that means.
Senator Thomasoni?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber, it looks to me like they're already required to do that, and this bill isn't making them do anything new.
It isn't
because
anything
new. Because that's current law. The new stuff is just the underlying part of the bill, and so but Ms. Abbott-Holden could probably tell you how they do it and what they do, and maybe that's a better way to explain it.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Weber, this is just updating the Adult Mental Health Act, which is what this is, and the language was kind of old in terms of how we think about employing people with a serious mental illness, so we just updated the language. And I will say that the Adult Mental Health Act is within available appropriations, so frankly, they get off the hook a lot.
Okay. Well,
Senator Weber.
Thank you. Rookie question.
That's okay. Senator Dames and Senator Nelson. Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who would like to answer this question, but the handout that had Russ's personal story on it, page 3, it shows the Deep Vocational Rehabilitation Services, the IPS, and then also the Space Practices Support and Employment Grants, but it only showed 8 counties. My question is, will this money and these services be extended to all counties or just strictly for these 8 counties?
Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahm, we would expand then beyond other counties. There are other extended employment projects that serve people with a serious mental illness but don't do IPS, so this will allow more of them to do this.
Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair and ma'am, can you tell me what criteria will be used then and how you will determine what counties you'll be expanding in?
Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Chairman, I think actually perhaps John Sherman from DEED would be better able to answer that question than me.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Sherman. I'm policy analyst with Vocational Rehabilitation Services. Sherman, S-H-E-R-M-A-N. The Vocational Rehabilitation Services Unit at DEED. Historically, these projects have sort of come online 2, 3, 4 at a time over the years. The initial projects date back to the early 1990s. Typically, it has been a competitive grant process with applications initially targeted at rural areas where services were not delivered. And then within those constraints, a competitive process for essentially looking at the best possible provider, typically looking at cooperation with county units. This in an earlier version that is pre-IPS. Essentially, the current projects are historic projects, and so they follow sort of the path of the first two, then the second three, with the target of trying to get as many scattered around the state and begin to develop a pattern of uniform coverage. And there are still significant areas in the state on a geographic basis that are not covered. And there are also significant areas of need within metropolitan areas that are not covered yet. And that statute, as the language as I would read it, would require a competitive process that, first of all, said that these projects need to meet the standards for an IPS project. And I assume that it's not stated in either the statute or in the language, but the intent of the department over 20 years has been to try and develop statewide coverage.
Thank you.
Senator, does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman, for clarifying. Senator Nelson, do you still have a question or comment?
No, I'll pass.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. Senator Tomasoni, is that the end of your...
I just need someone to move it here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Nelson?
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 644 be recommended to pass. And
it needs to go to the Committee on Finance.
And be referred to Finance.
Okay. Any further discussion on Senator Nelson's motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Thomas.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bonoff has our last two bills for the evening. Senate, which one do you want to take first?
7:30.
Senate File 7:30. Senator Bonhoff, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. It's nice to have a bill up in the committee I'm on. So I'm, Mr. Chair, I'm pleased to be here today with two jobs bills. And really, as we listen to the last bill, it always strikes me that the most important thing we can do here is, no matter what, make sure every person is working and working in a job where they can find fulfillment and certainly a living wage. So the first bill that we're talking about is the Small Business Investment Tax Credit. And I know Senator Nelson, previously we heard Senator Nelson's bill, and Senator Nelson's bill was an attempt to take the Angel Investment Tax Credit and give some preference for greater Minnesota. So first of all, I want members to know that I'm not opposed to that, and I'm sure that there's a way that we can work that notion into the idea that we're presenting today. The differences are that we actually, in the bill before you, we're putting some tightened parameters around a qualified business to make sure that our money is used wisely and gains the greatest amount of leverage possible. In addition, we are increasing the amount the state is investing to $20 million. And the governor, while this program, by the way, has been very successful, and my testifier is going to take us through that success, but the governor didn't put the expansion of this program in his budget. So I'm hopeful that, in fact, we will, as the Senate, make our recommendation that that, in fact, happen, because this program is doing exactly what we thought it would. And, in fact, the demand is exceeding the resources. And so it would be prudent not only to continue doing it, but to expand, as this bill does. So rather than take you through line by line, I thought I would turn it over to my first testifier, who, as he speaks very passionately about the bill, he'll also speak about some of the changes that were made. And John Alexander, who you're going to hear from, lives in my community, but I'm telling you, he is a tireless advocate for Minnesota's entrepreneurship community and for Minnesota's economic strength. So I've come to know him when I worked on the Science and Technology Authority. He's been involved with many, many things that have touched the Minnesota legislature with regard to expanded job growth. So with that, I'll turn it over to John Alexander. And you do, by the way, have a handout that was passed out that is a one-page summary that Mr. Alexander put together.
Thank you.
Mr. Alexander, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I have been in Minnesota for 21 years. St. Jude Medical brought me here 21 years ago as VP of Corporate Development, and I've made St. Jude my home after 15 previous moves. I'm mostly a medical technology executive, having played a variety of CFO and COO roles with emerging technology companies. But as I moved from large corporate America into the emerging technology market, it became clear, especially here in the upper Midwest, that there was a lack of organized angel and small-stage venture capital. And so as a CEO of companies, as a member of the management team, as an angel investor, I began to look at ways to organize angel capital. And in 2000, began to work with Buzz Benson at Piper Jaffray and Majority Leader Tim Pawlenty on the first iteration of this bill that took 10 years to pass. Since then, it's gone through one additional iteration, and as we see what happens around the country, and currently there are 24 states in total that have angel investment tax credits, there are things that we can learn as well as based on our own experience in order to see that, those funds can provide the most benefit to the state of Minnesota. The intent from the outset was to create and foster a high-tech environment, expand high-tech jobs, build kernels or clusters of high-technology businesses that would provide us some protection as the economy goes through cycles. And as you have seen over the last 2.5-3 years, the Angel Investment Tax Credit has been enthusiastically embraced. In 2000, while there was $11 million available for the entire year, when the bill was formally enacted in July, $7 million of that was drawn down, which resulted in $28 million of private money going into 67 emerging technology businesses. And the next year, based on a rollover of some of the funds that were available and not spent in 2010, 113 companies were spent, and $63 million was spent in private capital. And in 2012, that number was reduced because of the limits of $12 million being available to roughly $46 million in private capital going into 117 companies. The tax credit ran out of funds in the latter half of July last year. By estimates from Deed and myself, it looked as though we could absorb $18 to $20 million of capital this year. Interestingly enough, Wisconsin expanded their angel investment tax credit last year from $18.5 million to $20 million. One of my recommendations is that we expand the annual allocation to $20 million a year, both to match our nearest neighbor, who in the year before this bill was enacted in 2010, took six companies from Minnesota across the border in order to get funding. And so that $20 million will both match the Wisconsin increase and satisfy the demand. In addition to that, I have four other categories of recommendations, as Senator Bonhoeff mentioned, focused on trying to make it more efficient, tighten the bill to assure that the funds go where the funds are intended to go. First of all, the language in the bill that passed uses a very broad brush about proprietary technology, including patents, trade secrets, trademarks, copyrights, and the like. What we found is that companies are using a very broad understanding of trade secrets. And so technology that creates competitive barriers to entry, technology that results in a patent that prevents somebody from competing with you, is not the only standard, but a trade secret, which might be something that you keep internal that you don't share with other people, but you claim is a barrier, which may in fact not, may not be a barrier, has been used a number of times to satisfy this requirement. And it's our contention that if it were tightened up to include just patents, we'd have a better chance of seeing high technology, high paying jobs resulting as opposed to funding going into businesses that in fact cannot result in that kind of premium. Second of all, we've seen some very smart people identify the possibility of spinning off technology that has either received $4 million of investment or is over 10 years old into a new entity. The current language says the entity has to be 10 years old or younger or receive $4 million in equity or less. And so we've seen companies with technology as old as 25 years old get funded through a new entity that was less than 3 years old. We've seen companies that have had multiple levels of debt get funded, even though they exceeded that $4 million threshold. And so that spinning off, recapitalization, restarting, renaming, out-licensing one technology into a new entity has resulted in money going into something that has effectively been tried before, and we're throwing, maybe not in all instances, but in some circumstances, good money after bad. The third category is to limit the security to equity rather than convertible debt. This is a little bit more of a complex financial argument, but in the strata of securities that investors own in companies, debt is the most protective. Debt may be secured by assets. Debt is senior to other forms of equity. Debt can be secured by a wide range of intellectual property. And so debt has its own attraction separate from equity. When you make an investment in an equity in the business, you're making a bet on the company. And I think that's what the real intent of the bill was. We have also seen a significant problem with companies. Let me back up for a second. In 2008, when the market began to fall apart, post-Madoff, post-Petters, the housing sector financial collapse, the venture capitalists on the West Coast began to use convertibles. Angels in front of them began to use convertibles. I'm a member of Twin Cities Angels, and we began to use convertibles, thinking that in a down market, the argument about valuation was going to be so time-consuming and tedious that it would prevent companies from getting funded, and we'll just wait till smarter people at a later day come up with a valuation and rescue us from that conversation. What we found out was that while you might invest today at a 25, 30, 50% discount to that next round, is that in all too many circumstances, that next conversation did not happen. And so you'd end up with one round of convertibles on top of a second round of convertibles. And I'm disappointed to say that in some cases, a third round of convertibles, all tiered on each other at discounts. And so I personally have seen a number of deals in the last 12 months where if you were to convert the company, convert those levels of debt at the current market, not only would all of the founders be wiped out, all the current management team be wiped out, all the employees, all the seed investors that invest in common stock be wiped out, but part of the convertibles would be wiped out. And unfortunately, because the angel investment tax credit allows this, it encourages it. And so I would encourage you to consider excluding debt in any form from this vehicle and force
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Alexander, so are you saying that where we have stricken in this version debt with mandatory conversion to equity, are you now saying that you wanted to go farther than that?
Oh, I'm saying debt in any form. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that was stricken in this version.
Yes.
Yes, then I absolutely agree with that. I'm sorry.
Okay. So basically,
I must have an old version, a draft of the bill.
The bill before you is doing what you're suggesting.
Is doing what I would suggest,
okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for that clarification.
Thank you so much. The third or the last change is we've also had circumstances where investors have been aware that an event might occur in a relatively short period of time that would result in liquidity. Is this in the bill? It is. Okay. Well, then I don't need to talk about that. And then the last point was to encourage Deed to release certain basic information about the company, and that is there too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So those are all changes that are incurred. That concludes my comments.
Thank you very much, you. Mr. Alexander.
Senator
Bonoff?
Mr. Chair, I would also like to, at this time, I had meant to do this at the beginning, I apologize, but to offer the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment, getting the bill in the shape that I'd like. While they're passing it out, this is an amendment that was added to Senator Nelson's bill when it was heard, and I just want to make sure we don't lose sight of it, which basically also make sure that as we collect the data, that the number of qualified small businesses that are women or minority-owned are included in that reporting.
Okay. That's good. So members understand the author's amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. It adds the women and minority-owned section. Any discussion on this?
Yep.
Seeing none, Senator Bonoff moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The author's amendment is adopted. Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair.
Show him the bill and we can move.
I'm ready to have. Oh, and just also just one other small thing. So just to make sure members understand the difference between the primary difference between Senator Nelson's bill and this bill is that Senator Nelson's bill allowed for a 50% tax credit for greater Minnesota. This is the 25% that is just all, you know, over the state. And so there is a potential to incorporate the two.
Let's see. Okay. Senator Nelson.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bonoff. Actually, that's just what I was hoping that you would be amenable to, and that is I'd like to amend my angel investor tax credit language, the rest of it, onto your bill, which is the 50% tax credit for Greater Minnesota. You might recall we heard this last week, I believe it was, and you might remember that 95% of the funding currently goes to the 7-county metro area. And so the language that I'll be proposing in this amendment changes that tax credit for Greater Minnesota, that's the counties outside the 7 metro county area, to a 50% tax credit.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson. Senator, I'll have to look at the amendment. I'm amenable to that change. What I'd like to preserve is the other changes that I've made to the qualifications as expressed in my testimony and Mr. Alexander's. So as long as it's just that rate change, that would be fine.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, exactly.
Good. And do I have a copy of that?
I believe Mr. Fuller has the documents that we need or the words to incorporate this.
This might be a good time, too, members, and we're going to have this discussion, and Mr. Fuller is going to look at it. But as we are approaching deadline now, and I know we did some good work on some of the oral amendments, but the chair would like to request that we get these amendments to Senate Council ahead of time whenever it's possible, because the committee is only going to continue to get busier and busier, and I think it's a little bit easier for everyone to understand if we can have them in writing when that's possible. Senator Dames.
And I think that's a good idea, but we're going to need to get the bills a little quicker than what we're getting, and better for us to get our amendments and stuff ready. So we're certainly more than happy to work with that, but if we could get what's going to be on the agenda quicker, we can get that.
Senator Dames. Mr. Fuller?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask you a question. So what I have here, I have Senator Nelson's bill. So we didn't have time. I just learned about the amendment, so I don't have time to draft an amendment. You'll have to, I think the clerk is going to distribute the bill. I would then walk through her bill, find the stuff that she wants in this bill, and indicate it, then you would move it. Are you comfortable with that, Mr. Chairman? I don't know if it's going to work. I haven't looked at it yet.
Right. So, Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, another option would be, given that we have an understanding, Mr. Chair, between us of what wants to be included, and this bill does have a next stop, we could add the amendment at the next stop.
And Senator Bonoff, and I believe that is true, because I know that we did take positive action on Senator Nelson's bill. I believe it's in the Tax Reform Committee now, and if this bill passes, both bills would sit there. Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the time constraints that we have here, although I would prefer to get the bill amended in this committee if possible. And I appreciate your patience as well. Thank you.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson's fine with me if council would like to walk us through that again, with just the caveat that the only change that I'd like to make is the 50% for the greater Minnesota.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, that's my intent as well.
Good.
Okay.
Mr. Fuller. Members, if you'd look at this document then that was handed out, Senate File 285, we'll then insert the relevant portions into 730. The first one would be on 210 of 285. That would be included. It would have to become J. So after let's make this, we'll insert it after 2.9 on 730, the language from 2.9 to 2.0. Well, it has a different effective name, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Fuller, we will keep the effective date in Senator Bonoff's bill.
Okay. So then insert this, as I said, the language from 2.10 to 2.12 after 2.9, and then read letter on 2.10 of 730 I to J.
Okay. Okay, I can get you there. Senator Bonoff?
Mm-hmm. No, we have a lot more.
We have a lot more, yeah.
Subdivision 2, is that in the bill? Yes. Mr. Chairman. Then the language on 2.17 to 2.18 on 285, insert that in the appropriate spot in section 2 of this bill, which I think that's all we need to say. So in the same statutory section.
Right here.
And we can work with a legislative assistant. And the next language I see, and Senator Nelson, jump in there if I'm wrong, is on 3.1. Again, just insert that into the the corresponding spot in the statutory reference in section 2 of 730. On 4.4 of 730, insert that into the appropriate spot in section 2 of 730. On 4.17,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Fuller, can you just repeat that? Because it sounded like you said 7:30 and 7:30.
I did.
I caught you.
You'd insert it in the 285. Go easy on me, okay? And the day is late. 4.17 of 7:30. That definition goes... Go all the way to 4.23, and again, insert that in clause 2 in 285 in the same statutory subdivision. Okay, now we go to section 3 of 285. Let's see if that's in this bill here. Is it? I don't see it. Subdivision 5. Yep, that's in there. So the language on 4.29 from 7:30, insert that in the same statutory section that's amended in 285.
Mr. Chair, aren't we?
Senator Bonner.
Yeah, amending 285.
Five into 7.
Yeah, we're backwards for the last two. The last one as well. But yeah, I knew what you meant.
We're moving from 285 into
730. Into 7:30. Thank you.
Correct.
Yeah. And what are we going to do with the effective date on that one?
Mr. Chair, we will
Senator Nelson.
Keep my amendment is to keep the effective dates consistent with Senator Bonoff's bill.
So we won't make a change. Is that it? Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Fuller.
Since we're a committee reporting what our work is, I would suggest we make that amendment and then instruct the committee staff to ensure that everything that in 285, that is Senate File 285, that carries out the purpose that Senator Nelson said, which I think we did,
yes,
should be added to Senate File 730. I think that's appropriate for a committee to instruct its staff.
Senator Nelson?
If there's a concern, Mr. Chair, we could show a copy of the amendment to Senator Deems. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Fuller and Senator Bonoff, for your patience. This is very important to us, and I want to thank you for allowing me to offer this amendment today, as Mr. Fuller read, which is basically increasing that tax credit for Greater Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson and Mr. Fuller.
Could you please repeat that, Senator Bonner?
I was waiting for Mr. Fuller. Okay. I just want to thank Senator Nelson, and I'm pleased that we're adding it now. And I just wanted to thank Mr. Fuller for thank Mr. Fuller for his great work and trust that he'll do it just the way that he said.
A work in progress, Mr. Fuller.
Senator Nelson.
Yes.
I think I just want to advise that might be a good idea, even though you said you wanted to not change the effective date.
Yes.
I think maybe we should consider that we do that because you have some applicability sections for taxes.
Okay.
And if the intent of the committee is to adopt,
yes,
Senate File 280, amend 285 into 730, it would be appropriate to pick up the applicability parts of the effective date in Senate File 285.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Fuller, Mr. Knopf, thank you for catching that. We will then go with the original effective dates for those tax applicable areas.
Okay.
That's in my amendment.
We'll do whatever.
There's a test.
Okay, so. Understand your intent. Senator Nelson, we just move as an oral amendment.
That's what it is.
We'll move her oral amendment. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The oral amendment is adopted. Now, Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, members, for your patience. I have one final testifier, John. Well, there could be more that I don't know about, but John Scandura. And with that, I'll turn over to him.
Mr. Scandura, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about this bill today. So I'm John Scandura, the CEO of Aria Cardiovascular, a Minnesota medical device startup. And Aria is developing the first medical device for the treatment of pulmonary hypertension. It's a deadly disease that strikes in the prime of life. There's an average age of diagnosis of 37 years and survival of 6 years, so the prognosis is as bad as many cancer prognoses. But our experts believe we can save lives with this device, and we have a market potential on the order of $12 billion, so it would bring a lot of business to Minnesota as well. Aria is a classic Minnesota story. I was a fellow at the Medical Devices Center at the University of Minnesota. In collaboration with the hospital at University of Minnesota, my team and I invented the device. We filed the patents, built prototypes, tested the device, and so forth. And then my partner and I licensed the intellectual property, the patents, from the University of Minnesota, and we founded the company in 2010. We've located the company in UEL, or University Enterprise Laboratories, which provides affordable space in a startup environment. So we are Minnesota through and through. As you know, Minnesota enjoys perhaps the most fertile ecosystem for medical devices, maybe in the world, with over 30,000 very well-paying jobs. It's an industry that we really need to defend and nurture. The intellectual property and human capital available to startups here in the Twin Cities is tremendous, but there is a severe shortage of financial capital. And to put our capital requirements into perspective, the average cost and time needed to bring a device like Aria's to market is about $100 million in 10 years. So raising that kind of money in today's environment is formidable. In fact, seasoned medical device entrepreneurs say this is perhaps the most difficult time to raise funds since the inception of the industry. And almost every startup I know is struggling for its very survival at this time. So the headwinds, the reason why this is happening, the headwinds are too numerous to number, but I will say that there is a very important tailwind at this point that's benefiting startups, and that is the Minnesota Angel Tax Credit Program. For my company, it's been crucial in attracting capital. We've raised about $1 million, and almost all of it went through the Minnesota Angel Tax Credit Program, and I don't know where we would be without it. It really makes us makes the investment much more attractive to investors. So I'd encourage all of you to ensure there's adequate funding for the Angel Tax Credit Program going forward. The program has run out of money the last 2 years. Last year it happened on July 24th, so almost half of the year we were without the program. And when that happens, a big positive really turns into a huge negative, because investors will sit on the sidelines until that money is reallocated next year. So it pretty much shuts down investment when that program runs out of money. So I think expanding the program from 12 to 20 million certainly will help make sure money is there when it's needed by the startups. So just in summary, I strongly support expanding the tax credit pool and also extending the tax credit program for 5 years. It's really an excellent program. It's been it's highly responsive and well run from our standpoint. An investment like this will really pay for itself years down the road in generating more jobs in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Scandura, for your testimony. Senator Bonoff, anyone else would like to be heard?
Mr. Chair, I just want to acknowledge Dr. Scandura for the tremendous difference he's made for people's lives, and thank him also for his testimony. Thank you. And full disclosure, Dr. Scandura didn't actually agree with that part of the bill where we strike debt with mandatory conversion to equity, so it's all right if there was something you wanted to say. I was sticking with what I did, but I always like doubts to be aired.
All right.
Okay, I can
Mr.
just...
Mr. Scandura.
Yeah, I do have a different view on the convertible debt. Aria used convertible debt for all of our investments to date. And it seems to be becoming more and more popular with early-stage companies. And it's a financial instrument that affords maximal protection to the early investors. It minimizes risk that a pure equity investment cannot. So with an equity investment, like for instance, in my company, we just did a $1 million round. It's going to be followed by an $11 million round. So we have institutional money coming in next. These institutional investors may say, well, we don't like the stock price that you sold at already. And immediately those early investors can get hurt. So with convertible debt, when that institutional investor comes in, everybody ends up with that same stock price, so the early investors don't lose money. They like that as an investment vehicle, and it's and my understanding is that it's becoming more and more popular. And I know John has a different view on it, and there are shortcomings to it. There's no question. But you know, in this environment with the dearth of capital there is right now, we kind of need everything that we can use.
Mr. Chair, I am going to leave it the way it is in this bill, and they can, you know, continue to talk. And it's in the bill this time because of, I think, when we're putting our tax dollars in, that's a risk on behalf of the state. And so I think the risk goes all the way around.
Very good. Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 730? Is that the end of your testimony, mm-hmm. Senator Bob? Any questions for Senator Bob? Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bodhoff, I just really wanted to thank you, and I appreciate the fact that you took Senator Nelson's amendment. I mean, that's so vitally important for greater Minnesota, and so I just thank you for doing that and including us, too, in the greater goal for Minnesota. Thank you.
I'm pleased to do so. I'm excited about it.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonhoff and Mr. Alexander, just one question. Certainly, again, I repeat what Senator Rood said. But regarding to item 11 on page 3, the proprietary technology is not older than 10 years. I guess my question is, isn't it conceivable, recognizing that inventive minds are a lot of times far ahead of where the market is, and isn't it conceivable that there would be proprietary technology on the shelf somewhere for a company that due to the timing, due to the costs of developing, due to the maybe the market at the time, that it was not time for it at that point in time? And isn't it conceivable that a spin-off of a new company if the time's finally here to take that technology out, that this credit could also be a valuable tool for getting that technology out and a new business started?
Mr. Alexander?
Senator, Mr. Chair, yes, I would agree all of those things are conceivable. In a world of limited resources, though, and the probability that would compete with a brand new idea out of the university or out of a lab or out of a creative inventor's mind, where would you want the capital to go? All too often, maybe that's an exaggeration, on occasion we have seen technology that is that old or older that has gone through capital and time and iterations and trials and has failed time and time again. And then through that new birth, through a spinoff, through a new entity, through a licensing, to freshen the way it looks relative to the way the tax credit currently is, not in advance of the changes Senator Bonhoff has recommended, then it takes capital out of the system that caused the system to be without funds after July last year. And so if this was a $100 million program, I'd say let's throw as much at the wall as we possibly could. But in a world of limited resources, I would rather see, personally, technology that is relatively young get that first chance and get the stimulus associated with the tax credit, rather than something that is 10 years old or older.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alexander. If that's the end, would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 730? If not, Senator Bonhoff, I want to thank you for your hard work in this area. I know that you and Senator Nelson will go to Texas and fight hard for
us
in this committee. So, yes. Senator Bonhoff moves that Senate File 730 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Bonham.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next bill.
Senator Bonham, Senate File 352.
I'll invite my testifiers to come to the table.
Okay.
And I do have an amendment.
Okay.
The amendment is the A1. This amendment actually does change a little bit of the meaning of the bill. So rather than talk about the amendment first, I'd like to talk about the overall bill and then talk about the amendment.
Would you like to move the amendment right now, though, Senator
Bonham? Yes, please. Thank you, Mr.
All
Chair.
Right. Members are getting a copy of the amendment. This is the first stop, so it would be the author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author prefers. All those in favor of the A1 author's amendment, please say aye. Say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The author's amendment is adopted. Senator Bana, two-year bill, Senate File 352.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an exciting bill. As we look at where we want to incent job growth in our community, one place that can have the potential to bring a great amount of not just dollars but excitement to our community is the film arena. And members, in the past, we were one of the first states that issued a production credit for film companies to come to Minnesota, and then we stopped funding that. And at the same time, there was on a parallel path, Canada was actually doing a lot to incentivize film production to come to Canada, and so our film production really dried up and Canada's exploded. Now we're seeing that other states have brought this back, and so we do not want to let other states take the lead in this area. We want to be there. We think that Minnesota, for many reasons, is a jewel for film production. We have, you know, tremendous arts talent in our community, as well as great national resources that make us attractive to do films here. And also, in full disclosure, my son being in the film business, I'm trying to find an economic opportunity to lure him home. So so I'm proud to support this. And so rather than me going through the bill, I'll allow my testifiers to speak about that. But basically, we are bringing back a program and putting and requesting $10 million to give 25% of film production costs for films. With some, basically, I'll let Ms. Winter go through the details of the bill. Go ahead.
Ms. Winter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Lucinda Winter, and I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Film and TV. And for any members who are new to the legislature and are not familiar with our office, we're the state's film commission. We've been around since 1983, so we are supporting our 30th year now. And we're the only state film commission in the United States that's a 501c3. Other states typically have a film. All states have a film commission except, I believe, North Dakota. But all of the states that do have film commissions, it runs either through the Department of Economic Employment and Economic Development or through tourism. And we are in there's a brethren of us all over the world. So every country in the world has a film commission, even the poorest country in Africa. And the reason for that is because of the economic development and jobs opportunities that having that kind of liaison can bring to your community. The bill before you today really was first ruled into law, I guess, in 1997. That's when the Film Production Jobs Program was first introduced and went up, and our office administered it at that time, too. In your packets, you should have a packet. It's sort of a big, colorful packet. In that packet, if you flip through there, you're going to see Snowbait results 1997 to 2002, and that's just in there. I just wanted you to know that this is the documentation of the success that the program had in its first run, which ended in 2002 when it was defunded in a budget cutback. But it was a very modest program at that time, $100,000 cap per project. But as you can see, if you look at this, there were some really amazing results based on a 5 to 10% incentive. We were the first state in the country to offer this incentive to really at that time to stop production from running away to Canada. Now, then we had a second run of Snowbait in 2007 to 2011 general fund dollars, and I've also included in your packet the results on a spreadsheet from that program. With an investment that the state of Minnesota and the taxpayers made in this jobs program from 2007 to 2011, we spent about $4,400 million reimbursing production after the activity occurred. No production is reimbursed until after their economic activity occurs. They come, they shoot or post, and then we review their financial records. In our office, if it's over $1 million, it's an independent auditor that reviews their financial records, and then a check is cut. So this is truly an incentive that only occurs once the activity has occurred and the jobs have been created. So on that $4 million, we had a snowbait expenditures, direct expenditures of $28 million. So that's of between $6 and $7 return on investment per dollar invested. What we're looking in the interim, since general fund dollars went away and we've been funded through legacy, which limits the ability to attract outside production, this is the world, this plastic piece of paper that you have, it's the back of your packet. This is the world and the competition that I'm dealing with now. If you look at, this is just domestic. We are competing with the whole world, but if you look at the United States, we have a rebate. About 14 states have rebates. The rest of the states have tax credits, whether transferable tax credits or refundable tax credits. Some states, very, very few, have a non-transferable. California. This is the competition, and the bill before you is making a request that we as taxpayers, invest $10 million in snowbait, which gets us back into being competitive. But if you were to flip that chart over and look at any state you are curious about, you can see that it still puts us just in the tent, not in a hugely competitive position. I just want to get back into the game and see what we can do with it, because I know what we can do. If you look at Ohio, they've got $40 million in the biennium ending 2013. And if you were to look at Pennsylvania, for example, they have $60 million. So this is a business that many states have turned to help turn around some of their economies. And it's an expanding business. It's not just film. It's film. It's TV. It's everything you see on your phone. It's commercials. It's the digital monitors at the airport. All of this is being made, and about $200 million worth of this is being made in Minnesota every year. And that is down. The very last, for you who really like numbers, the very last thing I included is this snapshot of our industry code is 5121. Once a year, I hire a public policy researcher to pull the very latest numbers for us. And what this stapled together economic impact data sheet really shows is we have, over the last 10 years, there's been contraction in our industry at the same time that other states have really jumped on board and are offering the incentives. So it's really, this is a snapshot of an industry in contraction, which, of course, concerns me in a lot of ways, partly because as much as I love Medical Alley, not all young people in Minnesota want to wear a lab coat. A lot of them want to work in the creative arts, and we need to support and diversify our economy by supporting those arts as well. Under the bill itself, as I said, this is an existing program. This language has been around since 1997. The underlying parts of the bill are where we are making changes, and the changes include a move for our administrative oversight to be from into Indeed. And currently, we're in the Department of Administration. They do we report to them, and they do our oversight. We really should be Indeed. We were Indeed earlier in the first go round. We were Indeed, and in an administrative change, we were moved into tourism, and then we were moved into the Department of Administration. So we really feel that we are a true, full fledged job creation vehicle, and want to be Indeed. The other changes are.
Highlight the main ones.
The main one, yeah. The other big ones really are: we are asking for a change in our percentage of our rebate to a maximum of 25%. That allows us to incent different types of production, maybe some at 20, some at 25. And in fact, if you go to the back end of the bill in 219C, we are changing it from up to 20% to up to 25%. And that would be our maximum. A lot of states now are in that 25 to 35% pocket. So 25, again, gets us into the tent. And then maybe we should talk about the amendment language.
Yep.
Okay. And I have, I can do it if you'd like. Yes. Wonderful, it's typed up. So in the two references on lines 219 through 224, 2.24, where you see the number $5 million, we are altering the amount of money from the amount of a production's budget. So if a production has a $5 million budget, not all of that's going to be spent in Minnesota. Some of it's going to be post-production. So what we're doing is we're changing the limit from a $5 million limit to a $1 million minimum Minnesota spend. And what that really does is it allows us to ensure with that $5 million, we have no control over how much of it is spent in Minnesota. We want to make sure that they're spending at least a million of it in Minnesota in the metro area to get the 25%. So it's a way for us to ensure that the dollars are being spent here, that an appropriate amount of dollars are being spent here in order to attain the greatest incentive, 25%.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Members, I would also point out that we're giving an added incentive for Greater Minnesota. Again, we're saying that if you're in Greater Minnesota, you qualify for 25%. The only way you'd qualify in the metro area for that same amount is if, in fact, you had the costs in excess of $1 million. If you were below that million, you would only qualify for 20%. So, again, with this jobs bill, we're making, because we know how important it is to grow the economy in Greater Minnesota. We've made that distinction with this bill as well.
And thank that's, you very much. Yeah. Mr.
So, yeah, to add to Senator Bonhoff's comment, that is in our existing statute, and it does work to incent production into Greater Minnesota, which is something that we really support. The economic impact on some of our smaller towns of a film coming to town or a TV series coming to town can be really dramatic, even at a smaller budget level. It really matters.
So, Senator Hur.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Bonhoff. I just wonder if we can add the minority district in your amendment as well. In term that I know there's a lot of film making members in the community I represent. They don't reach 1 million, but I'm sure they get to the latest film was over $500,000. So. And that way it can also build up to the state economy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hur, so specifically, what is it that you're looking for? What kind of...
Senator Hur.
This is quite new to me. I just read the statement, so I really don't know the exact modification. I wonder, about the Greater Minnesota, if it could include, minority filmmakers into that category.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Hur, they would automatically be included. Okay. Everybody is included. So I guess the distinction would be to say that you would want the 25% to apply to, right now, the only way it's 25% in the greater metro area is if they spend more than $1 million, and so it sounds like what you're suggesting is that 25%, they'd also be eligible if they were a woman or a minority owned. Is that what you're suggesting?
I think that apply, yes.
That's kind of something we have to talk about, whether we can add or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hur, I wouldn't be ready to accept that amendment right at this moment as friendly, but I'm willing, and this does have another stop to go to.
Sure.
It will ultimately be in finance, and so let's work together.
Yes, it's
thank
quite
you.
New to me. This is very fresh. So
thank you.
I
let's work
rush.
Together
yes.
to see.
Yep.
Okay,
sounds good.
Yeah.
Senator Bonhoff, can we just ask one question on the amendment just for clarifying? Maybe you or Ms. Winter, Council's just got a question that we want to try to get clarified.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, on line 3 of the amendment, it uses the phrase minimum Minnesota expenditure, whereas mm-hmm. every other place where we're talking about expenditures on line 20 to 24 of the bill, 220, it talks about production costs, mm-hmm. which is a defined term. Is that intentional?
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Fuller, Bonhoff. Yes, it is, because what we're saying with production costs is it's the whole budget of a film, and what we're saying with minimum Minnesota expenditure is that they spend $1 million of their production in Minnesota. Ms. Winter?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Winter?
Senator Sparks and members, when I'm looking at the use of production costs in other places in the bill, it can be interchangeable depending mm-hmm. on if we say the words, as long as we say minimum. If you want, for consistency, if we wanted to say Minnesota, minimum Minnesota production costs, we could do
incurred.
That. Mm-hmm. We could do that to be consistent.
Okay.
Senator Bonhoff, this bill has some more stops. I think, like you said, if you want to stay consistent, you can continue to work on that. But
it might be
something to help kind of clarify it. Is there further discussion? Would you like to?
And I have one more testifier. Okay,
sure.
Dan Santoris, an entertainment attorney and film producer.
Thank you very much, Senator Bonhoff.
My
name is Dan Santoris. Thank you, Senator Sparks, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify today in support of the amendments to the bill. Just briefly, my background, I am a film producer. When I first came to Minnesota, I produced documentaries, corporate communication, television commercials for a number of years, and then started practicing law. I practiced in the field of entertainment law with a focus on film and television production, and I continue to produce films. Speaking to the bill's amendments, thousands of independent films are produced in the U.S. each year. Millions of dollars are spent, and budgets range from under $1 million to $20 million for independent films, sometimes more. Minnesota is capturing fewer of these productions than they could. Financing is the critical issue to all productions, and financing involves multiple methods, including, for example, equity, loans, debt, that is, pre-sales, deferrals, and soft money. And so what we're talking about here today in the bill is what in the industry we refer to as soft money, meaning government-provided incentives, usually in the forms of rebates or tax credits. The bill is for a rebate. Soft money is a critical element in financing almost all independent films. It's an important incentive to investors and the filmmakers and other financiers. In most productions, soft money is a critical factor in determining which state in which the film is produced. A strong soft money offering from Minnesota is an essential part of the ecosystem of the media production industry here in the state. Changes to increase the cap, as we are asking here, to $10 million and increasing the percentage to 20% and 25% are necessary to make Minnesota competitive with other states. So that I'd be happy to entertain any questions. Thank you for the opportunity, Chairman Sparks and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sartorius. Are there any questions for committee members?
Show the movie.
Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 352?
I'm sorry. We were asking whether we were going to show our video or not.
Mr. Chair, they had brought a short video about this subject, but if, you know, I always think when you have the votes, you just call the vote.
Right on.
Okay, that's fine. I'm sure it's a very good film, but I think let's, seeing the time.
Anyone who wants to stay will be happy to run it.
All right. Technology is great, isn't it?
Right.
Senator Bonhoff then moves that Senate File 352 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much,
Thank
Senator
you.
Bonhoff.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, committee, for talk. Some good work today. Yeah. With that, the meeting is adjourned.
Reminds me of sitting at the ball game.
Just a little.